who works for DPHHS and is the, I think still the Bureau, the title is Bureau Chief for the Chemical Dependency Bureau. That, I guess that's one of the things we talk about is, I think there's change going on relative to organization, and maybe you guys can touch on that. But prior to this position, she was the Injury Prevention Program Manager for DPHHS. And in this role, she worked with the state and local agencies to develop a comprehensive injury prevention infrastructure at the state level. She's worked at St. Patrick's Hospital with trauma services and attended the University of Montana at MSU in Billings and has a BA in organizational communication and certification in public health management from the University of Washington. Erin Ham is with us. Erin has been in the healthcare field for 11 years, with 7 in Montana Medicaid as a field representative with the Montana Medicaid fiscal agent and state of Montana as a program officer for both children's and adult mental health bureaus. And then we have Isaac Coy. Isaac is currently a treatment program manager for the Department of Health and Human Services in Addictive and Mental Disorders Division in Montana. Isaac monitors and coordinates with providers to ensure that there is statewide substance abuse treatment. And so they have a presentation, and then I'll come out and play Johnny Carson. Anybody remember Johnny Carson? And we'll field a bunch of questions, and we did collect a few questions ahead of time from our coordinator and stuff. So we'll turn, Bobby, is it you that's going to do this? Here's the
speaker.
Okay. You can use the mic.
Hello, everyone. So I'm Aaron Hoffman, the Medicaid State Plan Program Officer at Addictive and Mental Disorders Division. And we have Bobby Perkins, the Bureau Chief, and as a boy, the Treatment Program Manager. So we're going to speak to the AMDD and Chemical Dependency Division services that are offered. We're going to touch on some of the ACM criteria that is used to drive the individual treatment plans. And so I'm going to turn the microphone over to Bobby, and then we can just hold all the questions until the end. Thank you.
Hello, good morning. We're honored to be here to talk about this very important topic, substance use in Montana, and the funding sources under Medicaid and our federal funding with that block grant, as well as some of our other funding sources that have come into the state. Since Medicaid expansion, we've seen a lot of changes in Montana for substance use treatment. We have now approximately or over 96,000 people who've been enrolled under Medicaid, and substance use is a covered service. So this has really allowed us some new innovative ways to utilize some of those other federal funds and to look at how Medicaid can continue or to offer a continuum of care for individuals who have substance use disorders as well as mental health disorders. So we're excited to just kind of go through all of the changes under Medicaid that we've seen, and hoping that you all are supportive of Medicaid expansion, and we need to keep that in the state so that we can continue to provide quality substance use treatment for folks. So Isaac is going to take us through the services that we have added under Medicaid and some of the components of that.
Kevin around?
It's individuals must meet the poverty level, and they must be between 0 to 138% of the federal poverty level to qualify for Medicaid expansion. There's lots more criteria. And I'm not the best person to go into all of the criteria for Medicaid, but for Medicaid expansion, it is based on income. So if they're not qualifying for that, that could be one of the reasons if their income is above 138% of the federal poverty level. We do have federal funds that help cover individuals between 138.01% up to 200% of the federal poverty level that our state-approved treatment providers can apply for federal funds to help cover for those treatment services. So that's in our presentation. We'll cover that. Hopefully that will help answer more to your questions. Okay, so that's it. We'll go ahead and start with our presentation.
So, you see, the addictive mental disorders division houses a few different things. One is Chemical Dependency Bureau, the Adult Mental Health Bureau, Montana Chemical Dependency Center, which is in Butte, Montana State Hospital in Warm Springs, and Montana Mental Health Nursing Care Center in Lewistown. And our goal is to ensure availability and efficient delivery of appropriate and effective services for individuals with mental health and substance use disorders. So Medicaid substance use disorder services, as you can see, obviously the goal there is to provide maximum reduction of symptoms resulting from a substance use disorder. And Medicaid is used to support recovery-oriented services. As you can see, we have inpatient, outpatient, residential services that are covered under Medicaid. First level of care to talk about is ASAM 3.7. That's medically monitored intensive inpatient for adults and high-intensity inpatient for adolescents. So 3.7 is medically monitored inpatient. Obviously, these services are delivered to individuals with substance use disorder, moderate or severe, subacute, biomedical, emotional, behavioral, and cognitive problems are so severe that they require an inpatient level of care, but not the full resources of a hospital. Some of the services included, so ASAM 3.7 in Medicaid is a per diem rate. And that does include individual therapy, group therapy, family therapy, nurse intervention, monitoring, and psychosocial rehabilitation. Psychosocial rehabilitation at its basis is skills building. And 3.7 may be provided by a state-approved substance use provider who's also licensed to provide this level. ASAM 3.5 is clinically managed. That's a high-intensity residential. And it is a 24-hour supported setting. And once again, it's also that it's a level of care that doesn't quite require a hospital. It's a step down from 3.7. It also has a per diem rate that includes individual therapy, group therapy, family therapy, and psychosocial rehabilitation. The nurse monitoring intervention is on 3.7 because that's medically monitored. This one forces clinicians. We have a few programs in Montana that house both levels of care, and that's Remark Foundation in Billings, MCDC in Butte, and Recovery Center in Missoula that are state approved publicly funded. So they have both the 3.5 and 3.7 levels of care under the same roof. Bobby pointed out, we do have a couple programs that are freestanding facilities that are primarily 3.5. One would be Crystal Creek Lodge in Browning. They can also bill Medicaid, and they have access. They're state-approved. They don't have a contract right now for inpatient dollars, but they could as a state-approved provider. We also have some 3.5. Our licensure calls them recovery homes, but they are providing ASAM 3.5 level of care, so they're independent main facility. Rimrock has a few those halfway houses or recovery homes. We have a couple. We have single gender ones. There's a men's home in Miles City, men and women in Livingston, a women's home in a men's home in Bozeman, women's home in Kalispell, a men's home in Helena, and both a men and women home in Rocky Boy Reservation. So, and we have a few women and children homes. There are two here in Billings, and there are two in Missoula, and one in San Ignatius, and one in Helena. That's right. That's a newer one. So, 3-1, this is community-based. Like I said, so it's a community-based home. It's a supportive, structured living environment. And the goal there is to provide stability and skills building for individuals to minimize continued substance use as part of their disorder. There's a minimum of 5 clinical hours a week. And the 3.1 has a running board. It's it is not reimbursable through Medicaid. However, it is reimbursable through contract with the Chemical Dependency Bureau using those federal dollars that Bobby mentioned. And each of the recovery homes in the state has a contract for that running board. And you have to be state approved, and you have to be licensed for this, providing this level of care as well. ACM 2.5, this is partial hospitalization. It's very similar to on the mental health side, day treatment. It's usually provided in a 3-7 facility. So these are individuals who, they're going to live in the community, and they're going to come into the facility to do a lot of their treatment services. That way they have access to the full complement of services that are offered at 3-7. They're able to make a go of it and live. It includes 20 hours of skilled treatment services a week. Our administrative rule right now dictates that that is minimum 5 hours a day and 4 days a week. It is also per diem rate, and it includes individual therapy, group therapy, family therapy, and psychosocial rehabilitation. ACM 2.5, this is intensive outpatient treatment. So that is a 2.1. Wow. I'm adding new levels of care all the time. That's good. So IOP is 9 or more hours a week for adults of skilled treatment services. And 6 or more for adolescents. Those skilled treatment services, of course, can be individual, group therapy, family therapy, psychosocial rehabilitation, educational groups, vocational, recreational therapy. IOP, a program providing IOP under all of our, most of our state approved programs provide outpatient and intensive outpatient. They're approved. And they have contracts with $7. Regular outpatient, ACM 1.0. This is less than 9 hours a week for adults and less than 6 hours a week for adolescents. Services typically include motivational enhancement, strategies, individual family therapy, group therapy, and any related services. The other services covered under Medicaid is biopsychosocial assessments. So this is a comprehensive multidimensional. This is where you would obviously have a clinical interview, determine a diagnosis, and a recommendation for treatment and level of care. This can be a licensed addictions counselor working in a state-approved substance use disorder program or a licensed mental health professional with substance use disorder in the scope of their license. There are a couple notable exceptions to that. There is a statute that requires LACs to provide and confirm the diagnosis for people entering Montana State at Montana Chemical Dependency Center. also in a statute that for DUI assessments, I'm familiar with, the DUI statute does require LHCs and a kind of group program to do community assessments, as well as the corporate referral stamp CDC, and that's under administrative rule that would require those assessments to be done specifically by licensed addictions counselor. Screening, group intervention, or referral to treatment, that's ASPR, it's an evidence-based approach. It's a public health model, it's really identity. It's really, its intent is to identify individuals at risk for psychosocial or healthcare problems related to their substance use, to determine if they need a complete assessment or treatment, and refer them a warm handoff to the appropriate behavioral health provider who specializes in that. Right now, under Medicaid, state-approved providers can bill for ESPRT, so can physicians and mid-level practitioners. Drug testing. Under Medicaid, obviously, as you're familiar with drug testing, but it is definitely a therapeutic tool that can be used for patient care and monitoring their ongoing status as they work through treatment for their substance use disorder. In Medicaid, it has to be provided by a... So there's two different drug testing, obviously. There is one that would go through a lab, and that would be your typical your analysis or blood test. But this drug testing that is reimbursable for state approved providers is the collection, handling, and testing of a sample other than blood. So that's why I heard it says dip strip or saliva. And under our manual and administrative rule, we do limit it to one test per 24-hour period per member. And all of these services that I went through are in our AMDD services provider manual. It's on our website. It does talk about all these services. It includes both mental health and substance use. It talks about the service requirements, the provider requirements, any medical necessity criteria, and does have an extensive section that describes utilization management. So the first three that I talked about, 3.7, 3.5, and 3.1, do have to go through our utilization management process in order to guarantee that people are receiving the appropriate level of care, that they meet that medical necessity. So our manual is incorporated into administrative rule. It's written into administrative rule. The manual references the ASAM criteria. So that is required. We recently had some rules that repeal any duplicative or contradictory or outdated language in our administrative rule and move that into this manual. Services. Now we're moving past the Medicaid. These are the ones that would be covered under what Bobby mentioned through those federal dollars, our Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Block Grant. So the non-Medicaid contracted services, there's three things that will have to happen in order to provide those. The program needs to be state approved. And if they're providing 3.5, 3.7, 3.1, they also have to be licensed to provide that level of care. And those services can only be reimbursed if you have a contract or a task order with the department and funded through the CD Bureau. I think we have 30-some contracted providers, three tribal programs that are task order, Blackfeet, Rocky Boy, and Fort Belknap are state approved and have a task order for non-Medicaid services.
So I just want to add, we In the last legislative session, House Bill 95 allowed us to expand treatment, state approval to more treatment providers. So prior to last legislative session, we had 30 state-approved providers across the state. We now have 48 providers that are covering more counties, so we do have more providers. And I think it's probably closer to maybe 35 to 40 of those providers have requested funds, access to those federal funds. The combination of our SPR funds that Percy mentioned earlier, as well as our cooperative dollars. So there's more funding, more programs, providing services.
Thanks, Bobby. So this is a list of the non-Medicaid SUD contracted services that are available to providers to request that funding for. One is what I mentioned earlier, the Marine Board for the Recovery Homes. And the reason we can pay for that is because room and board, the housing component of that level of care is an integral part of that level of care. So we're able to do that. Medicaid can't pay exclusively for room and board, but the block grant can't. Rehab aid. I put it up there as rehab aid because that's most of our providers know it as, but it's that psychosocial rehabilitation, that skills building piece. And we have it defined as a one-on-one face-to-face service focusing on those individuals, and it's only offered and available if they're in the recovery home. So that piece isn't available to outpatient clients, only clients who are currently residing in one of those recovery homes. We also have peer support. That's new, newer. So, of course, these are peer support specialists. For those of you who aren't aware, we do have now certification through the Board of Behavioral Health that went through last legislative session that now covers. There's a behavioral health certified behavioral health peer support specialist is the complete title under the Board of Behavioral Health. The applications up are individuals. I think I checked yesterday, there's six individuals fully certified in the state. There are numerous individuals in communities that have been through trainings and have their applications in. We have some programs, a couple in the room here actually, that do employ peer support specialists. And the services that they provide, we have listed in our non-Medicaid contract manual that say what they can do, direct services. And we have those also listed as one-on-one, right now, one-on-one, and face-to-face. And those services have to comply with what is an administrative rule for the certified peer support specialist, and that's really based on core competencies outlined by our federal government. And we also have pre-trial services. We offer this to some of our contracted providers that they can do pre-trial services for individuals that have not yet been sentenced. So if somebody's awaiting sentencing from jail, they have a couple of providers who have contracts to do assessments, and one that requested to do individual and group in jail. Block grant can do that, but only, like I said, only because they have yet to be sentenced. If this is somebody on probation or parole who has gone to jail, that doesn't count, because they've already been sentenced to be on parole. So, that's how they got there. School-based services, these are early intervention services. They're kind of prevention, kind of treatment. They're right there in the logistics. Look, you might lump them in with that. And I put them in the middle on their own, but they are part of that continuum of care of services available. They're delivered. We do require the providers to give us an evaluation plan prior to being able to deliver the services, and that they have to be an evidence-based practice that explores and addresses problems or risk factors related to substance use. The idea is this is serving the kids in the schools that are high risk and maybe been in trouble for some issues, but they don't yet have substance use disorder. Special projects. That is offered to providers that they can use to provide programming that's based based on an evidence-based practice that isn't necessarily one of these other services. We have a few providers who request it, psychosocial educational groups. And there was one unique one. But I can't remember off the top of my head what it was that they requested to do special project funding. Restaurant travel, which right now in Block Grant, if you're contracted, we do allow mileage reimbursement for travel from the main facility to the satellite facility. We provide services to individuals, or if you're traveling into the community, to do services with them outside of the office space setting. We also allow reimbursement for some training. Training, so social care providers can request that in their contract as well. And it's maybe not like necessarily going for training like this, but like the idea of there will be bringing in a trainer to provide, and they train on motivational interviewing, and they've opened it up to other providers to come attend that training in house. And that has to be prior approved by the department. In medications, we do allow reimbursement for co-occurring medications. And in some cases, MDT meds, and the medications are reimbursed at the rates that are located on the Medicaid pharmacy fee schedule. So as I mentioned, also on our website, on the main page in UF page, was the Medicaid manual. We also have a non-Medicaid contract manual that is applicable. Covers those non-Medicaid services, and it's just for the contracted providers. And so as a result, it's a supplemental information to the contract, because a lot of the requirements are located in these providers' contracts, but there are some additional things in the manual. There's a description, and some of the criteria and service requirements in each of those services I just listed are located in our non-Medicaid manual, as well as some billing and eligibility. As Bobby mentioned, it talks about the federal poverty guidelines, so the 0 to 20%, and it kind of gives some outlines on how you would achieve somebody's income, because we follow modified adjusted gross income guideline under the Affordable Care Act and COVID regulations. So these are the general financial, but I just put this up there. So Medicaid, as Bobby mentioned, is 0 to 138% of the federal poverty level. And non-Medicaid, it breaks into two pieces. So if you're between the 138% and 200%, that inpatient, outpatient, residential that I described on Medicaid is covered for individuals who are above the population of non-Medicaid. So it falls under non-Medicaid. It's the same service description, and provider requirements, but it's just a different federal poverty level, a different population. I make too much to be qualified for Medicaid, as Bobby mentioned, to that one question, but I'm still under 20%. As far as the all non-Medicaid services on the slide, those are available for individuals all the way from 0 to 200% because they're not covered in Medicaid. So Bobby, I also want you to go through briefly our, if you're not familiar, the six dimensions that are in ESAM, risk ratings, and some considerations that providers would look for in each dimension. Dimension one, risk ratings first. So when somebody does utilization review right now, and in general when you're identifying somebody for an appropriate level of care, ASAM outlines four risk ratings. There it is, 0 to 4, obviously 0 being no risk or minimal, 1 mild, 2 moderate, 3 significant, 4 is severe. If you have 4, that's you need immediate attention. Dimension this is really how ready is the client to make changes. Stages of change, that's what you're looking for. Dimension 5, this is how able is the client. What is their skill set? What are their deficits? What do they need to work on? What coping skills do they have? On their own, what is their ability to reduce their use or avoid relapse or continued use? Dimension 6, that's your recovery environment, the person's living situation, your social family support, their employment or lack thereof, their housing situation. Housing in and of itself is not a criteria, but it is something good to report, and it may increase their chances of relapse and be tied to the relapse potential. Obviously, if somebody's living with their dealer, that is definitely a housing situation we might want to consider. And then their financial legal. This is where legal goes. It doesn't go under, yes, it is behavioral. Maybe behavioral. It may think like it seems to fit under dimension 3, but it would be. Any questions? No questions?
Hey, Isaac. Isaac, can an individual receive a level 1 outpatient group and the individual session on the same day?
Oh, can they receive a group and an individual on the same day?
Yeah.
Yes, with an appropriate modifier.
What modifier is that, Isaac?
Parents are medicating over
a pill. Sure. A member can receive an individual session and a group session on the same day, as long as there is an appropriate modifier that's attached that indicates that it's a separate and distinct procedure. CMS has issued multiple guidance documents or providers that designate which modifiers are used to separate those services. So when the claim is billed to Medicaid, the modifier that separates that the service as separate and distinct is attached to the individual group therapy session. If you bill an individual and a group without a modifier, it will post an edit stating that it's a component of the other procedure. The modifiers used to separate as separate and distinct on the same day.
What's an example of a modifier?
There are multiple modifiers. A modifier 59 separates it as a separate and distinct procedure. CMS has also designated modifiers XE, XS, and XP. Now, CMS does define the medically appropriate use of each of those modifiers to separate the service. So there's guidance out on the Medicaid provider website, as well as the CMS website.
Let's follow up, because I think one of the biggest issues that we keep hearing about is billing for two groups in one day. We do a lot of, for example, MRT, moral recognition therapy groups, and process groups, and matrix groups, and part of IOP, meaning, a level of 9 hours or more a week. And so providers will sometimes do 3 hours, 3 days, and that will include an MRT group, a process group, or some other type of group. Are we in a position where we are able to bill for that at this point with Medicaid, or is it part, at one point, Bobby, you and I talked, and you could, your indication was you could bill Medicaid for one group and maybe the block grant for a second group. And so I don't know where all that sits, or a lot of people don't know where all that sits. Maybe you could address it.
Sure, I could speak to the Medicaid for billing multiple groups. Currently, the NCCI, which is the National Correct Coding Initiative, it's a CMS designated correct coding group, does not allow for billing Medicaid or multiple groups a day. You can have one group therapy CPT code filled per member per day, regardless of if it's the same or the different, or a different provider, or if it is the same or a different subject matter of the group session.
vaccination-wide?
In Montana Medicaid, we do not allow multiple group therapy sessions to be billed.
Okay, and under the Medicaid. I was told we were working on that to modify that so that we could. Are we still doing that?
We are looking into it. It's bigger than us. It's a huge issue, so it's not something that is an easy fix. What we have done in the meantime, recognizing that there are situations where individuals need to receive multiple groups on the same day, is under the block grants, we have allowed for special projects, as Isaac mentioned, and that's where providers can request the funding to cover a second or subsequent group session on the same day. So we are asking our providers to work with us by being innovative with their contracts, with our state group providers, to use their federal funds to augment this until we can get this fixed.
Okay. So they can contact you if they're an approved provider under the special projects area and maybe get a second group.
Anybody who is currently a state group program can request, if they have not already, funding for a special project. Feel free to contact me. If you are a provider and you're interested in becoming a state approved provider, please let me know. We'd be happy to work with you to get you state approved.
Since we've talked about special projects, I don't know if this is legitimate or not, but drug court participants are a very high risk, high need group when it comes to substance abuse. In order to break the cycle of addiction, it seems to me it's a group that would be good to focus on for prevention and intervention as well from the standpoint of risk and protective factors, because we know a risk factor is parental drug use and living in an environment where drug use is around, et cetera, et cetera. So if we were to do, for example, communities that care, which is a risk and protective factor program, with drug court participants so that they could impact that intergenerational substance abuse that occurs, is there a way to fund something like that, at least on a pilot basis?
Mm-hmm. Communities that care is something that we have two RFPs out right now for prevention. It's to kind of, it's time for us to renew our contracts for primary and secondary prevention in the state. So we have two RFPs, so I can't talk to a lot of the details of those RFPs, but certainly communities of care is incorporated into these our vision. And so we're looking for programs to implement communities of care. How communities want to do that is up to the communities to identify who the stakeholders are, to design their own communities of care coalitions and work. So it's really up to the communities to bring in those entities and those individuals to be a part of that process that fits the community. So certainly, to answer your question, it's really up to the communities.
So are those two RFPs the only dollars that would be available for that, or if there was a prevention program in Missoula that you're already funding, and the drug court in Missoula wanted to work with that entity to utilize communities that care with the participants and their family members that are in drug court, could they talk to you about such a program?
Certainly, and we also have some of our other federal funds that are coming in. So as we talked about earlier, or was mentioned earlier, the Strategic Targeted Response Fund, the STR funds, as well as the SOR, the State Opioid Response Fund. There's opportunities for input to come up through communities to say, here are some things we want to look at for our communities to fund for the whole continuum, whether it's prevention, early intervention, treatment, recovery. So I'd be happy to visit with anybody afterwards on some of the mechanisms to get that information up to the stakeholders that are kind of making the decision on how to disseminate those funds.
If you're not aware of risk and protective factors and you're not aware of communities that care, I would encourage you to go online because our drug court participants are prime targets for this type of intervention. Are there other questions? Yes, Shelley.
My question is about peer support. We have some graduates that have gone through the peer training and they're certified. Is there a potential for them to get paid for doing this work once they're certified? And what's the process? Do they have to work for an agency? Can they do that as individuals?
Everybody get a question? Okay.
I can speak specific. Did everybody hear the question?
I think so.
Oh, I can speak specific to the substance use side of that. Under our funding, under SDR and Block Grant, there are providers that are allowed to do peer support if it's within their contract. And so if there's a peer out there, if you're an agency that has a Block Grant contract, you could request some of that Block Grant contract to be for peer support.
I have a question.
So on our handout, it says our high-risk high-needs participants able to get adequate treatment. So if under ASAM criteria, someone is recommended to complete IOP, at this point, many of them have difficulty accessing IOP. There are not agencies that can provide it fully in our community. It doesn't seem like that's happening.
So I guess the question is, we've got providers, but a lot of them don't offer that 9-hour minimum level of care.
Because they can't bill for it.
So they can't bill for it. But you said you have that level of treatment that you can only bill for 1 hour. We don't have 9 days. We can't bill for multiple groups on the same day.
You need 9 hours.
Right. Yeah, 9 hours.
But the response was, that you can bill for two groups a day. We just have to bill different sources of different revenue streams, right?
Yes. This is not possible.
So Medicaid again does not pay for more than one session group a day. So recognizing that the model has been 3 hours, three times a week, is not covered by Medicaid. If it is every day there's a group session, that is reimbursed by Medicaid. If there is an individual in a group offered on the same day with a modifier, that is reimbursed by Medicaid. So, and additionally, you can utilize the block grant dollars to pay for a second session of group on the same day that you bill Medicaid for the first session. It is covered if you have a block grant contract and you requested to use those dollars in that way. That's covered. So it might be that the model needs to be either you pull from different funding streams to bill it, or maybe the delivery of those services is stretched out over more days than just 3 days.
Can I suggest that you put on the conference website when your presentation here goes up, that you put on that the formula for billing individual group, so that we can get IOP provided and we will know what the modifiers are? Because I've heard from several people our billing agencies aren't able to successfully negotiate the system to get in the right key in the right block to cut loose 9 hours per week worth of treatment.
Are they working with Conduit, Tim? Are your billers working with Conduit to bill Medicaid?
No, I'm not sure.
Because that would be something I would recommend. It's definitely, if you're getting denials back, reach out to Conduit so you can figure out why you're getting denials. If you're billing a group and you're billing an individual on the same day. Again, we know you can't bill two groups on the same day. Right now, that's not an option. And honestly, I'm hopeful that we can get this worked out, but I can't say for certain it'll get worked out. So in the meantime, state approval dollars can help augment for those second sessions of group.
Okay, thanks.
So, Bob, we're in the middle of an opiate heroin crisis in Montana, and I think everybody's kind of frustrated because part of our job
job is to remove some of the barriers so people can get easy access to treatment. And we're trying to do that as easy as possible. So I have an individual, I did 3 evaluations on because she's using every drug under the sun. So when I go to send her to inpatient, they have a hard time filling out the requirements because you have to have it sent off to Medicaid within 48 hours of pre-authorization. So each time that she is waiting for a mandate, she goes off and they always say, I have to go back in and update the eval that they're finally got her placed. But if I do what you said and don't do as many evals as you would like me to do, then she wouldn't get placement. So the evals are not paid for, so I'm doing all that for no cost because I care about this client and I don't want her to die. So I mean, there are so many barriers to getting people the services they need. It's kind of frustrating. We're not trying to take it out of the panel by any means. We just need some clarification and some help because we don't want to. And we have people that don't have access to giving to our treatment centers or anywhere because they don't have means of transportation. So we can't build a mental health session or a CB session. And that might be the only time we can make it for transportation. So we're missing opportunities. And it's kind of frustrating because we're putting more barriers to the clients than we need. So I don't know if you have how many ways to put ourselves in that.
So, Julie, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Julie, are you getting denial from your multiple assessments that you're doing?
Yes.
Well, because they're, you know, they come through the multiple amount of criteria. I have to update this email. I would like to have, see them as much as possible, especially in that time frame, because I have to keep them safe before I can put them in place because that would be a
and we're trying to stay on schedule.